Wednesday morning's Bible reading at Manchester 90.
How different the mood of that song is from this hymn, which you won't find in Spring Harvest Songbook, or indeed in many modern hymn books. Goes like this. These things shall be a loftier race than e'er the world hath known shall rise, with flame of freedom in their souls and light of knowledge in their eyes. They shall be gentle, brave, and strong, to spill no drop of blood, but dare all that may plant man's lordship firm on earth and fire and sea and air. New arts shall bloom of loftier mould, and mightier music thrill the skies, and every life shall be a song when all the earth is paradise. Used to be very popular, that hymn. Why don't they write hymns like that nowadays? I suppose it's because we don't believe in them any longer, that's why. Man's lost confidence in utopia. We stand on the threshold of a new millennium, but our courage is failing us. An atmosphere of disillusionment is in the air. It's been in the air for quite a few years now. H.G. Wells was hugely optimistic, a mouthpiece of humanistic optimism in the first half of this century. In 1937, he wrote this: "Can we doubt that presently our race will more than realize our boldest imaginations, that it will achieve unity and peace, that it will live in a world made more splendid and lovely than any palace or garden that we know, going on from strength to strength in ever-widening circles of adventure and achievement? What man has done, the little triumphs of his present state, form but the prelude to the things that man has yet to do." That was 1937. Took only 2 years to shatter that dream for Wells. Confronted by the outbreak of World War II, he sang a completely different tune altogether in 1939. "In spite of all my disposition to a brave-looking optimism," he wrote, "I perceive that the universe is now bored with man and is turning a hard face to him. I see him being carried less and less intelligently and more rapidly along the stream of fate to degradation, suffering, and death. The spectacle of evil in this world has come near to breaking my spirit altogether. Homo sapiens, as he has been pleased to call himself, is played out." It would be nice to be able to say that was just depression, born of the impact of war on a very sensitive intellectual. But it isn't so. Wells' pessimism has been reflected in many, many of the seminal thinkers of the second half of our century. What's happened to that dream of a loftier race? Well, it lies shattered. A utopian dream that few now believe in. But human beings have lost confidence in themselves. It's not that the problems confronting us at the end of the century can't be solved. The question that haunts us, I think, these days, undermining the optimism that was once so characteristic of our century, is whether human beings are responsible enough, self-disciplined enough, unselfish enough, just plain good enough, to implement those solutions. Older folk here will, I'm speaking of myself when I say that, not just final year students, may just about remember a fellow called Jode. Professor Jode was an agnostic for many years, a convinced socialist. He believed passionately in the ability of man to control his own destiny. But slowly that conviction was weakened, just as in the case of H.G. Wells, realism just did not correspond to his dreams. And eventually, Professor Jode put his finger on the problem. In a book entitled The Recovery of Belief that he wrote in 1952, he wrote this: "We on the left were always being disappointed. Disappointed by the refusal of people to be reasonable, by the subservience of intellect to emotion, by the failure of true socialism to arrive, by the behavior of nations and politicians, by the masses' preference for Hollywood to Shakespeare, for Sinatra to Beethoven. Above all, we are disappointed by the recurrent fact of war. The reason for our disappointment," he says, "is that we have rejected the doctrine of original sin." I think Jode was speaking ahead of his time almost there. The optimism of humanists and of early socialists, you see, all hinged on the fact that man was basically good. True, there were vestiges of his animal origins apparent in his personality, but evolution was systematically eliminating such defects. Man was getting better and better all the time, said evolution. So nothing could halt his progress towards godlike perfection and earthly paradise. But unfortunately, the evidence doesn't match that optimism. Victor Firkis, in a more recent book, Technological Man, says, "Modern man is very far from slaying the beast within. Why should we assume that the man of the future will be a completely new creature? What if the man of the 21st century combined the animal irrationality of early man with the calculated greed and power lust of industrial man, while possessing the godlike power of technological man? This would be the ultimate horror," he says. As I say, that loss of hope, you see, which Wells experienced and which Jode analyzed, has become reflected in more and more seminal thinkers of our world. The loftier race that we were certain would arise is now revealed to be a myth. Indeed, surely this is the real irony of the failure of Marxism in Eastern Europe in these recent months. It didn't fail because capitalism is a morally superior system. Transparently, it isn't. No, Marxism failed because where capitalism makes allowance for and even exploits the fundamental selfishness and greed of human beings, Marxism makes no allowance for it at all. It assumes people are going to be unselfish when they are simply not. Said Adam Smith in his Wealth of Nations, "It is not from the benevolence of the butcher or the baker we expect our daily bread, but from their regard for their own self-interest." In other words, if you're going to build an economic system, you better be realistic about sin, said Adam Smith. He was a vicar. He knew about such things. The reason utopian socialism fails is because it neglects this warp in human nature which constantly frustrates our attempts to build a better, fairer, classless society. And yet, isn't it true, isn't it strange, that in some haunting way, that longing for a better world, that longing for some more optimistic perspective on the future, tantalizes the human race? What is it? Just a dream of utopia that we have to entertain ourselves with, or despair? No, the Bible would say it is something more than that. The Bible would say that haunting longing for a better world is a memory, a racial memory of a paradise we have lost. And in our Bible study this morning, which is going to scan chapters 3 to 11 of Genesis, we look at the account of the fall of that paradise into the imperfection that we now know. Turn again to Genesis chapter 3 that was read to us. Three sections for our study this morning. First, the sin. Second, the consequences. And finally, the transmission of the sin. We'll start with the sin itself. The serpent was more crafty than any of the wild animals the Lord God had made. He said to the woman, "Did God really say you must not eat from any tree in the garden?" I hinted yesterday that in my personal view, when we get to Genesis 2 verse 4, history begins as far as the Bible is concerned. History, that is, in the sense that now we're reading something which can draw on human memory for its sources. But that doesn't mean necessarily that figurative language couldn't have been employed in recounting these primeval accounts, these primeval events. It's possible that choices and influences that were originally internal to the mind of Adam and Eve could be given substance, I guess, in the shape of trees and a serpent in order to make the telling of the story more easy. I say that is possible, though I'm inclined to think that the writer intends us to understand this narrative quite literally. It's true that animals don't usually speak, and I don't think there's any reason to believe the situation in the Garden of Eden was any different in this respect. The serpent's speech, I suspect, was supernatural, even in the context of paradise. For later passages in the Bible make it clear that the serpent was acting as the mouthpiece of demonic intelligence here. "The ancient serpent who is the devil," says the book of Revelation. Satan, it seems, found the natural stealth and cunning with which the Creator had equipped the snake a suitable vehicle for his own insidious campaign. And I want you to notice particularly the four elements he exploits in his seduction. For they've never altered. They still remain today the classic route into sin for us human beings. The first is doubt. Did God really say, "You must not eat from any tree in the garden"? Now, do you notice the overstatement there? Any tree? He knew perfectly well the extent of God's prohibition was tiny in comparison with that huge orbit of permission he'd given to man. But his aim is to sow the seeds of rebellion here, you see. And what better way than to portray God as a great spoil sport, the mean-minded parent who always wants to say no. He uses the same ploy today to undermine our willingness to accept the limitations God places on our actions. "Oh, Christianity," he says, "all those thou shalt nots, those rules and regulations, so dull and inhibiting." The woman, in her initial response, seems secure. She will correct this foolish animal's misinformation. But it's never safe to open a conversation with the devil, no matter how well informed or how well intentioned. You're unlikely to convert him, and he's very likely to corrupt you. Already, without her being aware of it in the least, Satan has persuaded her that God's commandments are a subject for human debate and discussion, you see. The woman said to the serpent, "We may eat fruit from the trees in the garden, but God did say you must not eat fruit from the tree that's in the middle of the garden, and you must not touch it or you will die." Is there just a tinge of petulant resentment there? After all, God had not actually said they shouldn't touch it. Was the woman perhaps exaggerating the strictness of the command, as a sulky child sometimes does? "Oh, you never let me go out in the evenings," when actually it's the in-by-11 rule that we're really complaining about. The devil is very quick to pursue his advantage. "You will not surely die," he says to the woman. "God knows when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened." So from suggesting that the command is unkind and small-minded, he proceeds now to a rank denial of the reality of the sanction. "You will not die." Here's a direct contradiction of what God had said. An explicit challenge to God's truthfulness and authority. It's a lie, in other words. The lie with which he has continued to dupe human beings into a false sense of security ever since. You can get away with it. The sanction is a myth. You can sin with impunity. You will not die. He says all this talk about judgment, hellfire and brimstone, it's just scaremongering, saber-rattling, as if God could possibly do anything so nasty to us. So you see, he denies both the goodness and the severity of God in a single breath. First complaining of the cruelty of God in making the commandment, and then assuring us he couldn't possibly be so cruel as to condemn us for breaking it. Here is his first tactic: to sow seeds of doubt about the trustworthiness of God and his word. And so we're introduced to the second factor he exploits: pride. Verse 5. God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. In other words, you are capable of being much greater than you are. God is just bluffing when he says no to keep you under his thumb. He wants you to be dependent on him, crawling to him. But you can do without him. Assert your will, make your own choice. Humility is a vice. Where's your self-respect? Break out of this servile submission. Reject his authoritarian tyranny over your life. Be free. Be independent. Be God. So here arises the fiendish logic of all revolution: that anarchy somehow possesses more dignity than obedience, that self-assertion is more admirable than self-abasement, that rebels are more heroic than servants, that men who break rules are somehow more authentically human than those who keep them. Marx and Sartre have said it at greater length, but not with greater effect, I think. Indeed, this is the Promethean arrogance that underlies all humanism. Man is never satisfied with the humble dignity of being made in the image of his Creator. He must grasp at deity itself. These things shall be a loftier race. We're not high enough yet, God. Glory to man in the highest. He is the master of things. And so from pride to the third factor the devil exploits: desire. When the woman saw that the fruit of the tree was good for food and pleasing to the eye and also desirable for gaining wisdom, she took some and ate it. She also gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate it. Notice the threefold appeal to the appetites: the physical, the aesthetic, the intellectual. We often think of lust as if it were exclusively a bodily passion, don't we? That isn't so. Human lust varies with personality and with gift. It is true there are some men who will sell their souls to possess a woman, but there are some men who will sell their souls to own a painting. And there are some men I've met who I think would have sold their souls to discover an equation. A man may fall victim to desire in any field. What we in fact have here is an example of the hedonistic self-indulgence, which is so peculiarly characteristic of our age. If I find something pleasurable, if I find something satisfying, if I find something enriching, then it has to be right. There's no question about it. Anything that inhibits my free expression, anything that places a check on my behavior, anything that stops me experiencing what I want to experience, must be wrong. Self-fulfillment is the ultimate goal of human existence. Isn't this the therapy of 100 cheap jack psychiatrists today? Isn't it the philosophy of Playboy magazine? So from desire, the devil turns to the fourth factor he exploits: weakness. Just plain weakness. She took some and ate it, and gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate it. See, the easiest way of eliminating desire is to surrender to it. Whatever the subtle appeals of Satan, they weren't irresistible, were they? The woman didn't have to talk to him. The serpent was, after all, an inferior creature that she was mandated to tame. Yet she soaks up its instruction like a sponge. The woman didn't have to take from the tree herself. The strength was there to say no if she'd exerted it. And the man did not have to accept his wife's seduction in this respect. No doubt evil is always easier when it comes to us clothed in sexual attraction. But here he abdicates his responsibility in the marriage bond. Instead of leading, he follows. So from beginning to end, it's a surrender without a fight. A pathetic capitulation. Doubt, pride, desire, and now not even a shadow of resistance. So often sin invades our lives, doesn't it, in just such a way. You will enjoy it, says Satan. Yes, I will, we reply. You deserve it, says Satan. Yes, I do, we reply. You can get away with it, says Satan. Yes, I can, we reply. It's a ridiculous rule anyway, says Satan. So it is, we reply. So we just give in. Monarchs of the universe, God made us in his own image, but we behave like jellyfish, moral invertebrates. The flesh is weak, said Jesus. He never spoke a truer word, did he? Now, when sin invades you and me, this is how it will come. What forbidden trees have we plucked? Whatever they are, you can be sure, doubt and pride and desire and weakness are the things that made us vulnerable. So we come to the consequences of the sin. They begin in verse 7. Then the eyes of both of them were opened, and they realized they were naked. So they sewed fig leaves together and made coverings for themselves. Shame, then, is the first and most immediate consequence. There was a kind of warped veracity in the serpent's claim. Rebellion against God has changed their perception of the world. To the pure, all things are pure, says the apostle, but to those who are corrupted, nothing is pure. Suddenly all kinds of possibilities flood into their imagination, which weren't there before. Now that they have chosen to throw off the Creator's order and establish their own norms for behavior, possibilities arise in their minds that make them blush. The discovery of sin introduces a new tension into their relationship, therefore. Suspicion, distrust, self-consciousness, embarrassment. They can no longer be completely open with one another. They no longer completely trust one another. They veil their bodies in a pathetic attempt to conceal their thoughts. They set up psychological defenses against one another. Suddenly they find they need privacy. And from shame it's but a short step to fear. Then the man and his wife heard the sound of the Lord God as he was walking in the garden in the cool of the day. And they hid from the Lord God among the trees of the garden. But the Lord God called to the man, "Where are you?" And he answered, "I heard you in the garden, and I was afraid, because I was naked. So I hid." Not only then must they now hide from one another, they feel a desperate need to hide from God. Not just because of the humiliation they feel this time, but because, says Adam, they are afraid. Are these the ones that wanted to be God? Why, like naughty children, here they are, crouched in the broom cupboard. What will he do when he finds out? They're saying to one another. But you see, there's no way we can escape the limitations of our human nature. An elephant can't fly. He hasn't got any wings. He's not meant to fly. He wasn't made to fly. And a human being can't play God. We weren't made to be God. We weren't made, designed for that role. We may in our impudence choose contrary to God's will, but it's a futile defiance. We wave our fists at him in vain, because he remains the king. There is no way we can divest him of his omnipotence. No way we can reverse the arrow of moral responsibility. We are his creation. And it is utterly pointless to try to evade the consequences of our creatureliness. And yet that is what we so often seek to do. Some of us perhaps, in our arrogance, imagine ourselves arraigning God before our human tribunal on the last day, giving him a bit of our mind, indicting him with all our complaints. But it's all pretense, isn't it? We know that if we should ever meet God, it would not be like that at all. It is we who would cringe, terrified, not he. We who would have to give an explanation of ourselves, not he. So when we are in a more realistic frame of mind, what we try to do is keep him at arm's length. Like Adam and Eve, to flee his inexorable advance, we hide in our activities, in our books, in our alternative relationships. Any bush will do. They call to the mountains and the rocks, fall on us and hide us from the face of him who sits on the throne. But there is no bush, no mountain, big enough to shield us from the face of our Maker. So when we meet him, we discover a third consequence. Excuses. Verse 11. He said, "Who told you that you were naked? Have you eaten from the tree that I commanded you not to eat from?" The man said, "The woman you put here with me, she gave me some of the fruit from the tree and I ate it." Here perhaps is the most characteristic human response to sin. We think to escape our shame and our fear by passing the buck. Adam blamed Eve. Eve blamed the serpent, and the serpent hadn't got a leg to stand on. Long books, you know, have been written about the origin of evil. It's a problem, we're told. How did evil invade a world that was passed wholly good by God's own verdict in the beginning? Where did this strange evil come from? Two answers have been chiefly proposed, and you catch a glimpse of both of them in this dialogue. One answer is that of monism, which says that both good and evil originate in the one God. That's Adam's line. "The woman you gave me, see, it's your fault, God. If there's a blunder here, you initiated it." The other answer that's often proposed is dualism. Dualism sets up two equal and opposite powers in the universe, God and the devil, attributes all the good things to God and all the evil things to the devil. That's Eve's line. "The serpent deceived me," she says. The fact is, the Bible rejects both those alternative solutions. On the one hand, it insists that God is not the author of sin. He is unutterably opposed to it. Monism is excluded. On the other hand, it refuses to make Satan equal with God. The serpent is explicitly stated to be one of the creatures God made, which he originally pronounced good. So what's the answer then to this mysterious origin of evil? The truth is, the Bible never gives us one. And I suspect the reason is because in the Bible's view, it is an illegitimate question. We human beings are only interested in the origin of evil because we're looking for an excuse. As Adam and Eve were. We want to say, "There, that's why I did it. It's all because of that. It's my genes. It's my parents. It's the social system. It's that woman. It's that devil." We want to rationalize our sin so that we can evade its guilt. That's the only reason we're interested in the problem of evil. The Bible won't allow us to do that. Evil cannot be explained. It lies outside the range of causality and logic. It's essentially irrational. There was no valid reason for man's sin. That's the whole point. It was an act of culpable folly. There may have been mitigating circumstances. There may have been other factors implicated in the crime. But that serves only to moderate the penalty. It can't reverse the verdict. What Genesis 3 wants us to realize is that mankind is guilty. The buck stops here. The only valid response to our sin is not to look around for some source for this strange evil that has invaded us so cruelly. The only valid response we're permitted is confession. I did it. It began with me. I am the origin of this evil. But confession is humiliating. And we prefer to keep our self-respect by looking for excuses. Excuses that don't exist. For deep in our hearts we know nothing makes us sin. We are not the victims of compulsion. We choose. And because we choose, we are responsible for our choices. 3 verse 17. To Adam he said, because you listened to your wife and ate from the tree about which I commanded you, you must not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil you will eat of it all the days of your life. It will produce thorns and thistles for you. And you will eat your food by the sweat of your brow until you return to the ground, since from it you were taken, for dust you are, and to dust you shall return. So one more consequence of the sin. Judgment. There's much that could detain us for a long while in the judicial penalties that God imposes here upon the man and the woman, and we can do little more than just list some of its components. But notice what they are. A disturbance in human relationships, for a start. In verse 16 at the end, your desire will be for your husband and he will rule over you. So the harmony and the equality that had characterized their relationship at first would now be distorted by the demands of sexual passion and by the tyranny of physical strength. A disturbance too in the created order. It will produce thorns and thistles for you. That control over nature, which man would have enjoyed, is forfeited. Ecological balance will now elude him. The elements will threaten his very existence, causing him anxiety and toil. Suffering, too, enters the world, you notice. I will greatly increase your pain in childbearing. Through painful toil, you will eat of it all the days of your life. Significantly, the area of childbirth and of daily labor, surely those things which ought to be the focus of the greatest fulfillment for men and women, marred by pain now. But most characteristic of all, of course, death. For dust you are, and to dust you will return. Remember, the possibility of immortality was available to Adam in Eden. There was no prohibition regarding the tree of life. But now we read a flaming sword would guard the way to it. All man's achievements, no matter how noble, would end in the futility of the grave. We have a word in our 20th century that expresses much of man's frustration. It's the word alienation. Here is the source of it. Alienation within marriage, alienation within work, but supremely alienation from God. The Lord God banished him from the Garden of Eden to work the ground from which he had been taken. Now Adam didn't leave God behind in Eden, but he certainly did leave behind the privilege of walking with God without shame and without fear. And the tragedy is that he left it not only for himself, but for all his posterity. The innocence he lost here could never be recovered. Sin had entered the world. The rebellion had begun. And now Adam's children would be born outside Eden. For them, paradise could only ever be a memory. And that brings us to the third element in our account of Genesis 3 to 11, the transmission of sin. Now, we simply haven't got time, obviously, to look at the subsequent chapters of Genesis here in detail. But suffice it to say, they chronicle the way this vicious virus of sin, which has infected the human race, brings death and misery in its wake to everybody and to everything. Chapter 4, for instance, recounts the story of Cain and Abel. It startles us with the news that the first baby to be born turns out to be a murderer. Ever thought of it like that? And the divine curse is reinforced as a result, verse 14. Today you are driving me from the land, even further alienation, you see, even further banishment, and I will be hidden from your presence. I will be a restless wanderer on the earth, and whoever finds me will kill me. And interestingly, do you notice what Cain does to try to cope with this alienated existence of his now, east of Eden? Verse 17. Cain, we read, builds a city. There is something sinister about man's ambition to urbanize his environment in these early chapters of Genesis. I don't find any doubt about that in my mind at all. God gave man a garden. Now severed from God, man tries to build his own alternative. Perhaps there's a depth we don't realize in that modern phrase we use of the sort of the urban sprawl, the concrete jungle. Perhaps the city is man's botched version of Eden. God is too obvious in nature. We must exclude his disturbing testimony with bricks and mortar. In our hostility to God, we must try to surround ourselves with the artifacts of our own human creation. So out of the city of Cain, we find a culture emerges. Later on in chapter 4, we read of music and metalcraft and farming and so on. That image of God has not been completely lost, you see. Its creative imagination that we were speaking about yesterday is still there. But it's a godless culture. An alienated culture. The city of Cain is the secular city, the place where men hide to forget God, and the place where, consequently, moral standards inevitably decay. Now it is in verse 19. Lamech marries two women. The beginning of polygamy is noted, almost in passing. And note, too, the savagery of Lamech's song in verses 23 and 24. I've killed a man for wounding me, a young man for injuring me. If Cain is avenged seven times, then Lamech 77 times. See, it makes Cain's crime seem tame by comparison. Cain at least denied his crime. Lamech here boasts of it. Cain at least feared the vengeance of God. Lamech here is contemptuous of God's retribution. This is the world Cain has built east of Eden. A world where family life deteriorates in fratricide and polygamy, and where violence escalates. But again, most characteristic of all, it's a world of universal death. Look at chapter 5, this long genealogy. Cast your eye down it, and you will find there one phrase that keeps repeating like an ominous drumbeat at the end of each paragraph. And he died. And he died. And he died. And he died. The human race is multiplying as God said it would, but multiplying only to face the savage grief and despair of death. In the day you eat thereof, you will surely die. Chapter 6 then begins with a poignant description of how God was feeling about this appalling ruin of his beautiful world. See what we read in verse 4? In 5, rather, of chapter 6? The Lord saw how great man's wickedness on the earth had become, and that every inclination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil all the time. The first time God looked at this world, he saw it was good. Now he looks again and his verdict is utterly opposite. It's hard to imagine a more uncompromising expression of the depth of God's horror at man's moral depravity, the magnitude of it, how great it is, the universality of it. Every inclination, he says, is corrupted. The inveteracy of it, only evil all the time. The penetration of it, down to the very thoughts of his heart. This is not then the record of crimes performed by a small minority of mankind. This is a society in which everybody is motivated by evil, in which every construct of the human imagination is molded by wickedness. A culture, God says quite literally, beyond redemption. This moral decay which foolish Adam had introduced, which murderous Cain had confirmed, has now developed into an appalling epidemic of vice. And I want you to notice God's response to this appalling spectacle of evil in verse 6 of that chapter. The Lord was grieved that he had made man on the earth, and his heart was filled with pain. That's technically called an anthropomorphism. God is being spoken of as if he shared human emotions. Did I say as if? What makes us so sure he does not? Oh, it's true, nothing happens outside God's sovereign will, but that doesn't mean he approves of everything he permits. It's true, God never makes mistakes, but that doesn't mean he never has regrets, does it? It's true God is never taken by surprise, but that doesn't mean he can never be disappointed, does it? It's true God can never be thwarted, but that doesn't mean he can never be hurt, does it? As our song earlier was reminding us, the cross is there in time and history to prove to us that our sins, though they cannot defeat God, nevertheless tear the heart of the Godhead apart with suffering. God is grieved at sin. This is no naive anthropomorphism. It's a profound insight into the emotional life of God. Divine judgment is no mechanical, cold-blooded vengeance pursuing man like the relentless hounds do a fox. No, God agonizes before he judges. As Jesus wept, you remember, over Jerusalem. Make no mistake about it, as the rain began to fall on that corrupt antediluvian world, the tears of God were mingled with it. And we dare not read these awful words that follow in verse 7, except in the context of that grief-stricken divine countenance. So the Lord said, I will wipe mankind whom I have created from the face of the earth. Perhaps, God seems to speculate, perhaps a fresh start will do the trick. Maybe eugenics is the answer. Let's eradicate this morally corrupt human stock and start again with just a single family, the one family on earth I'm really pleased with. Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. I will make my covenant with you, says God in verse 18, and you will enter the ark. What a great idea. Start again with fresh stock. Surely now paradise will be regained. And indeed, after the flood, Genesis 9 does begin on a very hopeful note, full of possibility. Noah, like a second Adam, steps out of the ark into the pristine purity of a new world from which every trace of wickedness has been judicially purged. The rainbow sign of the peace treaty between God and man embraces the horizon. Surely now at last man would find his way back to the Garden of Eden, the paradise he had so foolishly forfeited. The creation mandate is reaffirmed in 9:1. God blesses Noah and his sons, saying to them, be fruitful and increase in number and fill the earth, just as he'd said to Adam.
Yet within a few verses, all our fond hopes are smashed to pieces. Verse 20. Noah, a man of the soil, proceeded to plant a vineyard. Oh, well, at least he wasn't building a city. When he drank some of its wine, he became drunk and lay uncovered inside his tent. It's possible, of course, to draw moralizing conclusions about alcohol abuse here. Certainly there have been countless others who, since Noah, have fallen victim to strong drink, but that really misses the entire point of this. What we have here is an ironic parallel to the tragic story with which Genesis begins. Adam falls by eating the fruit of the tree, Noah by drinking the fruit of the vine. Adam discovers the treachery of the serpent, Noah discovers the treachery of the grape. Both are humiliated by the exposure of their nakedness. And both end up with the harmony of a perfect world spoiled and dislocated by a curse. Verse 24, when Noah awoke from his wine and found out what his younger son had done to him, he says, "Cursed be Canaan." The difference is, you see, that in Noah's case, God takes no direct hand in the proceedings at all. Adam had eaten of the tree God planted. Noah eats of his own tree. Adam's nakedness was discovered by God's initiative, Noah's by his own children. Adam's judgment was pronounced by God. Noah delivers his own curse. But what we have here is not a second fall. It is that old fall rearing its ugly head again like some phoenix out of the ashes of judgment. The flood has not exorcised the demon in man. Sin is still there. The virus is alive and kicking, inherent, implicit, built into the very structure of human personality and human relationships. God has promised he will not curse the world again. He doesn't need to. For it's clear now that left to himself, fallen man will quickly curse it for him. Sin is not a single gene that could be bred out of the human race by careful selection. It is a corruption that permeates every department of every personality. No one is immune. Not even righteous Noah. This story is recounted to show us that that is so. This man whom God calls righteous has the same root of self-indulgence, the same inclination to the abuse of God's good creation that led to Adam's shame. And among his sons, there is the same mixture of honor and dishonor that led to the rivalry between Cain and Abel. So Genesis 9, that begins so bright with optimism, ends with the same old story of brothers divided by a curse. The flood had been a judgment against sin, all right. But it was not a remedy. Like radical surgery, it had reduced the tumor, but it hadn't eradicated its malignancy. The symptoms were still there, unmistakably sinister. Do you remember when Cain left home? He sought refuge in an urban community. It ought not to surprise us then that within a few generations, Noah's descendants are doing just the same. "Come," they said, "let us build a city." Let's look in these closing moments of chapter 11. "Now the whole world had one language and a common speech. As men moved eastward, they found a plain in Shinar and settled there. They said to each other, 'Come, let's make bricks and bake them.' Instead of stone and tar, they use mortar. And then they said, 'Come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens, so that we may make a name for ourselves and not be scattered over the face of the whole earth.'" I can't resist the thought, you know, that this observation about men moving eastwards has more than geographical significance. When Adam and Eve are expelled from the Garden of Eden, it is in the eastward direction. When Cain is banished after the murder of Abel, he migrates to the land of wandering in the east. And here is just one more step in that same direction. It's as if the writer of Genesis wants to tell us, here's humanity moving progressively further and further away from paradise. The flood may have interrupted that movement for a moment, but it hasn't changed the direction. Man is still committed to his own alternative, secularized utopia, east of Eden. And Babel, in many ways, is the archetypal symbol of that godless ambition. There is something, you know, in the aspiration of these migrants to the land of Shinar, the land of Babylonia, that in spite of its ancient context has a disturbingly contemporary ring, don't you think? Their enthusiasm for technological innovation. Let's make bricks and bake them thoroughly. Brick instead of stone, tar instead of mortar. See, they've got this creative intelligence of God. Confronted by the challenge of a new environment, they don't need to wait like animals for evolution to adapt them. They adapt their environment to themselves. If there's no rock, they'll bake mud bricks. If there's no mortar, they'll use tar. And how childishly pleased he is with himself. That the improvisations prove to be a positive improvement on previous engineering techniques. We can build towers now, they say. Wow, what an idea. New technology sparks up all kinds of exciting things in this fertile imagination of man. So his scientific discoveries become the prelude to cultural revolutions and economic developments. New cities, new architecture, new civilizations. We're familiar with such quantum leaps in human history. They have occurred many times, most recently in the Industrial Revolution, I guess. And of course, many people believe we're on the brink of just such a dramatic new advance today. There's nothing wrong in it, of course. Didn't God tell Adam to subdue the earth? That's what we were saying yesterday. Surely the architects of Babel were using their unique intellectual gifts as men made in the image of God to master their environment just as God told them to do. Well, that's true enough. The Bible never suggests there is anything essentially wrong with technological progress. But what does man build? And why does he build it? That's the question. The forge that produces the plough can also shape the gun. The pen that writes poetry can also write pornography. The chisel that carves sculpture can also fashion idols. Almost certainly, that's what this tower was, a Babylonian ziggurat designed to worship the stars. Let's build a tower that reaches up to the heavens. Let's get nearer to the stars. Hubble's telescope and all that. But more than that, it's an obelisk to human pride, you see. Let's make a city for ourselves, they say. Let's make a name for ourselves. This is man doing what he's always doing, his own thing in defiance of God. Glory to man in the highest, says the Tower of Babel. He is the master of things. No, to be true, that devastating flood has not taught us much. Evil is mushrooming again. Pride and desire and arrogance. And notice God's response to it this time. Verse 6. The Lord said, if as one people speaking the same language they have begun to do this, then nothing they plan to do will be impossible for them. This prospect, you see, which intoxicates the Babylonians, disturbs God profoundly. He has a foreboding, a premonition about it. Nothing will be impossible. Can he mean that? Has he really invested such dreadful potential in us human beings? Well, he should know if anybody does, shouldn't he? Conservative-minded Christians often respond quite wrongly to the claims of humanism. They hear eminent scientists assuring us that one day soon we will visit the stars, create life from inorganic materials, build a computer with self-conscious identity, and so on. And we say to ourselves, no, it's impossible. Only God can do such things. Proud man has a grossly inflated opinion of his abilities. I tell you, no. There is nothing inflated about man's opinion of his abilities. Humanists have not underestimated man's capacity for technological advance. If he sets his mind unitedly and determinedly on a goal, he can achieve anything. God says so. Nothing will be impossible for them. But whereas that thought excites the humanist, it horrifies heaven. What on the lips of a humanist would be a glowing testimony of optimism about man's glorious future becomes on the lips of God a grim foreboding of tragedy and disaster. For he knows what a dreadful responsibility omnipotence is. And he's utterly realistic about how irresponsible the human heart is. Man is simply not good enough to wield this power safely. And that's why, ironically, the more our technology has grown, the more insecure we have become. God saw it all long ago. And he did administer a remedy, you notice. Verse 7. Come, let us go down and confuse their language, so they will not understand each other. So the Lord scattered them from there over all the earth, and they stopped building the city. Many commentators treat this dispersion as if it were a judgment of God, but there's no indication in the text exactly of that, is there? We don't read God was angry, simply that he was concerned about where man's foolish charge towards technological achievement might lead him. Indeed, you could almost say it's an act of mercy rather than retribution. Rather, as a wise father will check his baby son if he sees him running towards a fire. God is diverting man's creative energies here from a suicidal course. Yet having said that, confusing human language was a very serious measure, wasn't it? More serious perhaps than perhaps we realize at first thought. We're beginning to understand these days that languages differ not just superficially in their vocabulary, but more fundamentally in the philosophy, in the logic, in the worldview they presuppose. Language doesn't simply express our thoughts, it shapes our thoughts. It controls the very way we comprehend things by its syntax. So by diversifying human language, God is introducing into the world a profound communication barrier, one which no amount of Esperanto or translation will be able to amend. Human beings will no longer think the same way. Their aspirations, their values, their culture will diverge with the language. They would not want the same kind of world as one another anymore. There would no longer be a universal consensus about truth. Nationalistic rivalry would breed distrust, disagreement, competition. It was all very regrettable. But it did mean that the technological revolution would progress more slowly. They stopped building the city. World empires would arise, of course, but they would now be short-lived, for other nations would vie for supremacy, and in the resulting collision, cultural impetus would be lost. Again, like radiotherapy, harm would be done to good as well as to malignant tissue. Great achievements would be lost and never recovered. But in the wisdom of God, it's better that way than to let the power of a fallen human race escalate unchecked. Better a world confused, he says, than a society which is single-mindedly going the wrong way. There are profound lessons, aren't there, then, in these early chapters of Genesis? A profound warning, perhaps, to us as Christians, that for us, utopian optimism is out. Whatever field we're thinking about, we of all people have to be realistic about the essential evilness of human beings. In our economics, we can't be naive socialists, even if we want to use that label of ourselves, because we know human beings are not good enough. In our thinking about unity in Europe, between East and West, as much as we may be glad to see a toning down of hostility, the possibility of real international cooperation, there must be at the back of our minds a caution. Anxious as we are to be peacemakers, there's a price that's too great to pay for peace. There are plenty of Nimrods in this world anxious to build new empires. A caution, too, about our technology. We do stand on the threshold of what Marshall McLuhan has called the electric era. All signs of new words are being written, straining the English language to express the novelty of the new information age. The Industrial Revolution of the 18th century, they tell us, will be nothing compared to the transformation that's going to characterize post-industrial society. George Thomson, the Nobel Prize winner, suggests that not since the invention of agriculture at the commencement of the Neolithic Age has man stood on the brink of such momentous change. And perhaps it's significant that this potential revolution is all about the science of communication. Marshall McLuhan talks about a global village. Wang Computers suggest that you should quickly get hold of one of their systems because it has the power to unite all your hardware and make it talk the same language. Do it, says the advert, before the babel of many computer languages sets your business in confusion. Well, we do well, you see, again, to be suspicious of such aspirations. One modern paraphrase renders the tower that reached up to heaven by the word skyscraper. Our modern technology is not something from which those who know the story of Babel can take unambiguous comfort, is it? Now, we Christians cannot be utopians. Whether we're talking about the family, whether we're talking about politics, whether we're talking about commerce, whether we're talking about technology, whatever we're involved in, we cannot be utopians. We cannot take the risk of relying on the goodness of the human race. It's folly. And yet, we must also be people of hope. Almost certainly we must be that. Perhaps you find the story of Babel a rather unsatisfying one. God's action here in confusing men's languages seems to have been very much a stopgap measure, doesn't it? They may have stopped building the city then, but they're certainly building again now, God, and with great success. What trick does God have up his sleeve this time? Now that man's overweening technology once again threatens to claim omnipotence. The answer to that, I'm afraid, may almost seem laughable by its weakness. It's actually there in 11, verse 10, though you probably wouldn't recognize it. This is the account of Shem, says Genesis. Verse your eye would glance over without a second look. Actually, it's the most significant verse in the entire first 11 chapters of Genesis. Yes, Babel's confusion was a stopgap, nothing more. God knew sooner or later man's arrogance would reach crisis point again. The diversification of language was just a preemptive strike to forestall that. For to put it bluntly, God is playing for time. He has a plan of salvation. He's always had it. Unlike Noah's Ark, this plan would rescue out of the jaws of his divine anger not just a single family, but an innumerable multitude. It's a fantastic plan, so lofty in its conception, even the angels had no idea of it. A secret purpose hidden within the secret counsels of the Godhead from eternity past. But it was a long-term project. It needed time. God intervenes at the Tower of Babel to give the world time. Time for what? This is the account of Shem. 2 years after the flood, when Shem was 100 years old, he became the father of Arphaxad. Arphaxad lived 30 years and became the father of Shelah. Shelah lived 30 years and became the father of Eber. It gets rather a long list. I won't bore you with it all. It's there, you see, so we know why God needed time. For century after century, the divided nations go their way. God does not interfere with them again. He doesn't have to. He's checked the immediate danger. From now on, his interest focuses down on a single family among all those scattered peoples. A Semitic family of the tribe of Shem. A clan called Abraham. And it's there in the promise to Abraham that the Bible finds the ultimate answer to man's need of hope. Abraham began life in a city of Babylonia, significantly. Archaeologists tell us it had a particularly fine ziggurat, but that's probably just coincidence. What is interesting is the direction in which Abraham's pilgrimage took him. Leave your country and your people and your father's household and go to the land I will show you, says God. And God sent him west, not east. At last, man's drift away from paradise has been reversed, you see. For Abraham is not looking for Babel. Babel is the city man's built. The New Testament tells us Abraham was looking for a different city altogether. A city foundation whose builder and maker is God. And if you're here tomorrow, as I hope you will be, we shall begin to tell the story of that better city.